From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Employable Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and games development. I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games.
In this episode, we talk with Amir Satvat, founder of ASGC, always supporting the game community, to discuss the job market. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
Lydia, when you said the job market, you didn't say it with the fear in your voice.
That's because I didn't say it.
As the only one who is employed here, I don't know.
I tried really careful about how she said that. Yeah.
But I'm also trying to hype myself up. Let's be honest, to put a little bit of mustard on there for myself.
Yeah, that's real.
Hello, welcome. It's good to see you. I had the pleasure of seeing your panel or little round fireside chat at GDC. Welcome, Amir Satvat.
Thank you so much, Lydia. Thank you, Mark. And thank you, Stephen. I really love the theme and message of your show, and certainly anything that emphasizes good and positivity and having serious discussions about things that matter a lot to people in the industry. You know, I'm all in, and thanks for having me.
Wow, put that on the dust jacket.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right.
We try.
Well, we are going to try to keep the mood light and optimistic,
because
I think that's the tone that you've set. But maybe before we get into the sort of the tough questions, tell us a little bit about the work that you do.
Absolutely. Well, you know, everybody has these turning point experiences in their lives, I think. And a big one for me was I actually didn't start working in games until I was almost 38 years old. I had done a lot of really cool things in finance, business strategy, a lot of things functionally similar to what I do now in business development in my day job at Tencent. But because it was really important to me to live in Connecticut and near my family, and I have a very tight-knit Persian community here, I didn't want to move, and there were no jobs in the Northeast back then. Anyway, when I finally broke through in games, my reaction to having gone through that hard period of having to want to work in it since I was a kid is, some people say, well, I had it hard, so you're going to have it hard too. Some people said, I had it hard, so I want to make sure nobody else has it hard the way I did. And so I started up a community, and the intent of it originally was just one resource, which was kind of put my own mark on games jobs in a really complete and unique way. And it grew and it grew and it grew to community coaching, free passes, support when organizations have layoffs, and so much more. And now it's grown into the largest support resource that exists in the entire industry. I'm proud to say that we've helped nearly 5,000 people find work. And even beyond that, I think the thing that I'm most proud of for ASG is all the people who tell me that beyond any resource, beyond any number, way the thing that is the most important to them is like the support. So 4 out of 10 people in our community tell me that our community was a major source of support to them, whether they literally found a job with us or not, just because of the environment and being there. So this is the thing that I really feel so passionate about and I'm excited to talk about today.
I think it's really beautiful also that you originally thought game dev was off the table because you really wanted to preserve your access to your own community. But then now you have made kind of your own access into the games community and then open that door up for other people in a way that, you know, maybe you didn't even think you had in the first place. That's really neat.
Oh, that's so lovely of you to say. No, it really is true. And, you know, look, it's not the right path for everybody. And, you know, everybody figures out what are the things they have to prioritize. But I think having now gone through it, it is really a gift because I can look someone in the eye who's any age, right? 21, even younger, 25, 50, who either has always wanted to get into games or get back into games. And I can tell them, I literally know how you feel. And they know it isn't some nonsense that I'm just feeding to them. It's the story of my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is an important part of it. Because I think that sometimes when you're looking for work, people will give you advice, not necessarily being in that same position. Mm-hmm. And speaking personally, it is frustrating to hear that advice.
It's also hard because it changes. And now that there are, for example, games degrees, then if you didn't go through school when that existed or a school where that wasn't an option, it's very tempting and easy to go, well, shucks, I missed my chance.
Right. Well, everyone's situation is different, but you're providing resources for all of those different situations, which mm-hmm. is extremely valuable for people. So thank you for that.
So this job market. Dun, dun, dun. Is that better, Mark?
Better, okay, Lydia. Cool. I'm terrified as
quaking in your shoes. Yeah.
How would you describe the job market right now?
That is a big question.
It is a big question. Let's start here.
Like, yeah. One thing I would say that's really important is how I think about the community. If the one big hidden thing that I just said is just the general support, I would say the second biggest hidden thing about the community is, because of the amount of trust we built up with the community, and I promise this is leading to an answer, and because we don't charge for anything, people share a lot with us. Candidates share with us what's going on with their searches, with layoffs. Companies share with us all kinds of info for HMs and for recruiters. And by us, usually it is the entire team, but in this case, I do mean just me. And kind of the one-to-many trust that I have means that between all of that and all the stuff that I've even just gathered myself through primary research over 4 years, what I'm about to tell you comes from a perspective that I say with all humility, but I think we may have more info on the game's job market than anybody else in the world.
Okay. Mm.
And so because of all this data, what I'll tell you is it is very tough, but a lot of the gloomy things that I think people see are maybe a little bit incomplete.
Okay.
Let's lay a baseline that's going to help us throughout the session, right? Mm. So a lot of people ask how many people work in video games. Mm-hmm. That seems like a really simple question, but it's actually not at all. Conventional answers you'll see will say 300, 350, 400, things like that. A great Discord called Game Industry Coffee Chat, they did in a really good top-down estimate that I looked at with a fine-tooth comb, and I accept that estimate, which even on the like conservative end for them was 700 to 750,000 people. Mm. That is how many people I think work in games. Now, the reason that's important is many people miss major markets like China, like other parts of Asia and others, where there's a lot of hiring and headcount going on. And so what I tell people is, if you look at the last 5 years, total employment in games has actually grown very slightly.
Okay.
It's grown by maybe a few thousand people over 5 years. Now, one, the compare to that is that the 5 years before that, 2017 to 2022-ish, the industry grew by 100 to 150,000 people. Right. So let's just say we're flat to make it simple. We grew by 100 to 150,000 the last 5 years. And the last thing I'll say is, AI gets an awful lot of discussion and justifiably so. But what I tell people, and I tell them maybe this will change in 6 months and 12 months, as of right now, I believe the biggest dynamic of the last 5 years hasn't been that. It has been geo-relocation of jobs in the sense that we've been shedding jobs predominantly from North America and Western Europe, and other places, again, predominantly Asia, having a pickup. So what I tell people is, you know, that global number is easy when I'm sitting with my Excel doing it overall. It's different when you're the person in LA who can't pay their mortgage versus the person in another setting who's picking up jobs.
Yeah. I really appreciate that perspective because, I mean, as somebody in the U.S., we tend to be pretty centric towards the U.S.
Oh,
sure. Well, yeah, it's hard to see outside your perspective.
Yeah.
And this is kind of like a globalization thing, right?
Yeah.
Like there's always two sides of it. When jobs move overseas, people get jobs. Like,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
if you're a fan of humans, it's not actually that depressing.
Yeah.
But also if you're a person who wants a job in where you are, you know, your own perspective, you know, carries a lot of weight.
For sure.
Is some of that flattening and that relocating in part also because being able to work remotely and having the trial by fire, but then like, you know, solid forging afterwards of noting, hey, you can actually do game development remotely on a team if you have a good team. Has that also contributed in the sense that, you know, if you were a game developer in, say, Taiwan, you wouldn't have to go to Montreal. You wouldn't have to go to LA to get a job in game devs. You could be in Taiwan still.
I think that the phenomenon you're describing is accurate, but not because of the remote reason.
Mm.
So I should have mentioned this. Remote employment in games actually has gone down, but then stabilized. So when I started tracking it in 2022, you know, it was still like 30% plus of roles were remote.
Yeah.
It fell. And by like 2024, that number ranges between like anywhere between 11 to 15%. Huh. So 11 to 15% of roles in games are remote. That's it. But what you described is accurate, more just because local roles are coming up. And so the person in Vietnam would be like, well, I can work for this company in Vietnam rather than going to one of the big markets. And the other fact is, as I'm sure the three of you know, the difference in compensation is pretty stark. Like, yeah, as an extreme example, I remember I was talking to someone in LA and a big well-known company had one opening for an artist. For that same cost of one artist, they were telling me that they could hire 7 to 10 people in Latin America. Mm. Now, I know that, you know, you could make a debate, but like, I don't think even if that person is amazing, it's 7 to 10 times right. worth the value necessarily, or at least that's a very hard debate to have. And I think that's a lot of what's happening in many situations.
Mm. I guess I can speak to this a little bit as somebody who's currently unemployed and has been actively looking. I think that I've struggled with finding work in the current marketplace, but I'm, you know, like you were saying, a lot of the jobs, a lot of people are able to make games outside of the US or the used to be traditionally game dev places. And I think a lot of that is because like game dev is way more accessible than it ever was. Mm-hmm. And that's important and valuable. I think that has changed a lot of the landscape of how games are being made. And I think that's an important aspect of it. But definitely from my perspective, it definitely feels like I have not been able to find a lot of places to apply for that aren't looking for me to like move to France.
you're not saying I'm having a hard time getting all these offers.
Yeah.
You're saying actually what the positions available to pursue
is
a big part of the job.
Yeah. I see jobs posting all the time, but not ones that I'm particularly qualified for. And specifically, I mean, like, I don't have the expertise of an artist. For
sure, sure.
And
I would not describe your employability as niche.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm not a niche person. My work is not niche.
Do you think maybe that's, and we'll get our guest's view on this, but I want to hear from you.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a matter of the people who are in games is so diverse that everyone is a little niche?
Mm.
And so even if there's a lot of jobs, it's maybe for your specialty might be a problem?
That might actually be a little bit of it. I've noticed that like there have been applications for things that have been real specific about a thing. Mm-hmm. So like I have done a lot of game design work, but I haven't really done level design work. And when people say level design, it means different things to different companies.
Yeah.
Which is a part of the issue. But I have not done the level design work that a lot of people looking for a level designer has done.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I don't feel qualified to apply to those positions. I mean, I can do it, but like,
you'd have to advocate really hard and argue for it.
Yeah.
Or you need an employer who is looking for someone with skills that can transfer to whatever their house needs.
Right.
So let's ask Amir this. So do you find that, I mean, certainly there's the advice you give to applicants, but just generally in terms of what's out there, is it such that the types of roles, there's so many different types of roles that it makes it hard to find? Or is it a matter of not identifying which roles actually are in your wheelhouse?
It's a great question. So what I tell people is that I kind of divide the challenges into three categories.
Okay.
So the one is just what I call like the waterfall, which is just generally there's a huge supply-demand gap for jobs, right? So as an example, we have 10 times the number of games program graduates that we had 10 years ago. Yes. That's like 20 to 30,000 people a year who are coming out of games programs looking for work. Mm-hmm. When I shared the odds on this, because I can calculate it pretty precisely, and I shared this quite some time ago because it hasn't changed terribly much, it kind of shocked people. So my numbers suggest that over 12 months, if someone is early career, 3 years or less experience, and they're looking for work in games, their chance of finding it is 5%. Mm. If someone is a veteran, their odds are like 30 to 40%. Mm. For all candidates, the odds are like 15%. Those are the odds.
Quick clarification, by veteran, is that everybody who is 3 years or beyond in their game dev journey?
Correct. Thank you for the clarification. Yeah. But I should add, there actually is an ageist angle at the end, which is you get to 50 or older, your odds drop down to early career. So your odds become like 5% again.
Dang.
And so what I would say is if that's the waterfall, then the second factor is discipline. So what discipline you're applying to varies an awful lot. So of the like 18 major disciplines, everyone has their slightly different categorization. I have one that, you know, they're all pretty consistent.
Yeah.
But it's like in games, there's the big four, right? Production / project management, engineering, art and animation, game design. That comprises 75% of the jobs in video games.
Right.
Of those four, the one that way has the worst odds is anything related to game design. Game design, level design, weapon design, any of these things. The total number of jobs in game design in the entire world for all seniority levels is something like 700 to 1,000 roles. Wow. Only like a third of those jobs or 40% of those jobs are in North America.
Yeah.
And so that's even game design. When you go into subfields, like let's take like writing and narrative, there's 60 writing and narrative roles in the entire world. Of those, like there's maybe like 30 to 40 in North America. I have 600 people just in my own community who are looking for writing and narrative jobs.
Dang.
So like if you get into a sub like writing or narrative or audio, it's very hard.
Yeah.
So the final point I'll say is the point of geography. Games is also a very geographically concentrated industry.
Yes.
So if you take North America, 75-80% again of the jobs are in a small number of areas. California, Washington State, Vancouver, Quebec, North Carolina, and Texas. If you don't live in one of those places and you don't want to move to one of those places, you've now basically just cut out of the of already the haircut of, so take the total jobs, take the total jobs that are in North America, so you're now haircutting at 70%. Now let's say you don't want to move to one of those five or six places, you're now haircutting at another 70%. And then now you're haircutting the jobs for your actual discipline and what's available. So when you start doing all those haircuts, that's why you start getting 700 to 1,000 people applying for a job.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
That makes sense.
That really puts it into perspective. Okay. Sorry, Lydia.
We're going to get three individual couches here. We could all each lay down in.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah, we're going
to... This is why I'm always smiling, because otherwise it's like, I feel like when I go to places, it's like seeing the Grim Reaper, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's important because there's two sides to this. There's the sort of going in with lots of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed and not knowing how rough it's going to be, because then that shock is debilitating when you find out.
Right.
And then there's the going in with utter pessimism.
Yeah.
And then basically you can sort of, you know, hurt your own chances and be just a miserable time.
Yeah.
That's right. And I think the flip side of this is, you know, I just gave you the hardest, most bitter pill, awful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Everything has offsetting points. And here are the offsetting points. The offsetting points are what I just quoted you as the odds for looking for 1 year. If you find other work and continue looking, those odds aren't linear. They start going much higher and higher for a lot of intuitive reasons, right?
Yeah.
People are networking, they're looking, they're getting their name out there.
Right.
And the other positive thing is like, everybody has some degree of geographic flexibility that they can go after.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people generally do tap that geographic flexibility. And so like, look, I think again, some of the disciplines are very hard, especially if you're early career, and I can't candy coat that. But I will say that now that I have 4 years of data, people who kind of hang in there for like the long run are like, well, it's not that big of a deal that I have to go to Google or I have to go to Nike or I have to go to like whatever and get a job or go to Boeing and get a job there for like 1 or 2 years.
Mm.
I see a very healthy number of them, certainly not all of them, coming out the other side eventually.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also, and I think like you are living proof, and I think we are all living proof to some extent that, you know, what we end up doing before we get into game dev ends up being valuable in our game dev journey in some way.
For sure.
Yeah.
And so that's, if you aren't in game dev for the first however many years, that's not wasted time. You're still learning things that you will then access.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think there's a, you know, everyone's journey is different.
Yeah.
And if you're, you know, if you're 22 coming out of a program, of a college level program, and your background is education and you have no other experience,
yeah,
then your possibilities are wide open. You can go any direction. You have all the time in your life to get there, but you have no experience to make you stand out. And then on the other side, you have, you know, if you got there through a circuitous path, so that's true of me and true of a lot of people, you have an advantage because you are a unique applicant, mm-hmm. but you don't have the time or maybe the resources that you could have built over time. So it's
right.
I not just identifying the market, but identifying who you are seems to be important.
Yeah. And honestly, I'm really appreciating the numbers behind it because it really puts it into perspective.
I think like even if you are going to take a pessimistic route to it, it's a lot. I don't know what the right word is. It's not easier. Maybe it's a little bit more comforting to be pessimistic about a solid thing as opposed to an unknown.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Yeah, yeah. Like knowing the numbers makes it feel more real in a way. Like, I know that it's difficult, but now I know how difficult it is and I can work with that as opposed to it just being generically hard.
Yeah, you know you're getting a haircut.
Yeah.
You officially know you're getting a haircut and then you just have to decide which one are you going to get.
Yeah.
I think to point, like, the slice of this that I worry about the most is it's like, it's crazy. Like, when I go to any event, inevitably, like, forget even like professionals talking about their own situation. Someone will come to me who's a parent and they'll be like, Amir, I have a kid who wants to work in games. And I'm like, okay. Oh. And I'm always very empathetic and supportive. And I'm like, I'm thinking in my head, you're 90% going to tell me they want to work in game design. And then they're like, and Johnny wants to work in game design. And I'm like, of course they do. Because like, I feel like, you know, this is like the hardest part for me is for early career, not having everyone separate into such a small number of disciplines that they're coming out of school for.
Yeah.
And I'm sure maybe the three of you have seen this. There's a very famous like eye chart that Hitmarker made that makes the rounds every 6 months or something mm-hmm. that basically has a list of like every imaginable function that exists in games. And I tell people, like, this is what we should be showing kids. And anyway, like, my biggest point that I started with early career people, but now really is the biggest point I'm preaching to everybody is, nothing makes me more irritated than when I go to people who are saying, I want to help people in games. And I'm like, that's great. And I'm like, what are you doing? And it becomes clear to me when I diligence what they're doing, that 90% plus of their effort is of helping people get games jobs. Yeah. And I tell them, look, because we know the stats are literally the inverse of that, you need to be spending 80, 90% of your time giving these people skills and education about how to find other work, which is why when you go on our communities page, for example, I show 13 to 14,000 games jobs, but I show another 30,000 that are games adjacent because that's where I think it all is.
No, that's brilliant. That's definitely something.
Side note, can I say that I totally agree with the, like, there are more jobs that just design and out there and no one tells you that they exist. I so wish that as a kid growing up, we were exposed to all of the jobs that exist in the world or at least more of them. Cause like so many times I can imagine a kid thinks they want to be a doctor, find out that they don't want to be a doctor, and then don't know that like being an ultrasound technician or being in public health or being, you know, an OSHA compliant, like a safety person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
is a thing that they could, where they could practice healthcare, but they don't have to be a doctor.
Yeah.
But we just don't know that they exist because there's so many. Why don't we do this more with kids?
What's wild is that this really ties back into like a truism in game design, which is you aren't necessarily designing the mechanic. You're trying to get the player to feel something.
Yeah.
So like why, so the mechanic itself isn't actually that important.
Yeah.
Why do you want that to be? And so it could be something else.
Oh.
And that's true of, you know, of this as well. And that gets, it's sort of a truism in all areas of life, I suppose.
Everything is everything. Is that right?
It's correct. Yeah.
No. Anyway, that's my soapbox. I'm putting it aside.
No, I mean, I've said for years that it's like, it's a marvel to me that like there's not a core curriculum for people literally at like the high school level, if not earlier. It reminds me of how So don't get me wrong, right? There's a gender and sexist component to what used to be called home economics in the past. If you take that out and you taught it to everybody, I'm like, why doesn't everybody learn home economics? Why doesn't everybody learn personal finance? Why doesn't everyone learn public speaking? Why doesn't everyone learn like how to like build a resume and like look for jobs? Like, it's kind of like, it's almost like we decide you shouldn't learn that for any reason until you're like a senior in college.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My high school very intentionally taught public speaking, but that was the only thing on that list. And it was unusual. It is an unusual thing about my high school.
Yeah.
It is important to be looking for jobs that are outside of just games, because I think that like part of the reason why things you feel like you need to be specialized in it is because like you've been focused on working on games for so long, and games have all these different roles and things that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
But a lot of those skills can be applied in different ways in other fields that are not related to video games.
And I think it's probably also important when you hear that advice, if that sours you, if you're like, well, I don't want to spend that time away from searching for that.
Yeah.
How rational is it to say accept the consequences of that? Like, how do you guide people who are saying, well, I don't want to go be a programmer for some mobile app, even though that would be the best thing for me right now?
Yeah.
I mean, what I would say is, look, it's like not my job. I'm no one's dad to tell them what they should do. But what I can tell people is that, like, I have perhaps the widest viewpoint on what's actually been happening to people, not from like running a spreadsheet, but from actually talking to them myself. Like,
right.
Of the over 50,000 people who will be laid off by the end of this year between 2022 and 2026, I have a track on and or have had an interaction with easily over 30,000 of them. I field easily in many weeks over 1,000 messages from people. And so the amount of like up close and personal and gory details I get, I'm just grateful, kind of like maybe like Frodo carrying the ring, that like I can just take all those messages in and nobody else has to deal with it. And what I will tell you is all of that sounds good, but the number of people, so first of all, in our field, the average person has 3 to 4 months of savings or less in the bank. Two-thirds of them have less than 3 or 4 months of saving. And so I think all of that sounds good for eating ramen, but at the end of the day, most of costs for most people in this world is paying housing.
Yeah.
And most people, if they don't apply broadly, many of them will end up in situations where they can't pay their rent, they'll become destitute, they'll get into serious situations, they'll either have to go to debt, go live with their parents, even become homeless. And this is not like hypothetical. This is really, really terrible. And I've seen it happen to many people. And so I would just say, when I render this advice to people, it's because I have seen exactly what happens. And I have seen the variation, the average, the standard deviation, whatever, of the outcomes. And so, like, believe me, you don't want to be on the other side of that. Like, that's why I almost tell people my job is to make sure that you're not destitute and that you basically can pay your bills doing literally anything.
Yeah. I think that really speaks to why community, like the one you're building, is really important, because you need people who are coming in with an irrational sense, which is probably all of us. They need to be able to trust the data and trust the experiences of others. And in order for them to do that, they need a community that they can sort of, you know, buy into,
right,
so that they can make those choices that are best for them, even when they're not necessarily the choices they want to make.
Yeah, I mean this in the gentlest and kindest way possible. Truly, I do. Everybody thinks that they're going to be the exception. When everybody starts their process, no matter what I tell them, for many of them, not all certainly, but for many people, it's like there's almost like this 6 to 8 month lag where they don't believe me and they have to see it for themselves and see how hard it is and to try. I mean, the other thing I'll say is, and this thing I raised actually at GDC is, I always had a suspicion, but I didn't have the data to prove it. So I was like, I'll collect the data to prove it. I had a suspicion that this is a dynamic that happens all the time. I'll be chatting with someone and they'll be like, Amir, I'm starting my search. And I'll be like, okay, let me make a few suggestions. And the first thing I always tell people is, forget even applying outside games. Promise me you're not going to just apply to like the 50-100 dream companies.
Yeah.
Everybody has like the 50-100 studios that they've heard of, that their mom has heard of, that their grandmother has heard of. Everybody wants to work at Blizzard. Everybody wants to work at Riot. But I tell them there's over 1,000 games companies at any moment in time that are hiring. There's many thousands more that are non-game hiring. Promise me you're not going to apply to the Dream Studios. Everyone metaphorically nods their head and is like, yes, I'm here. But I have always suspected that they don't actually do that. And I can tell you, having now tracked it for almost a month, of all the games roles that I post, 70% of them on our site have not been clicked on or looked at by anybody.
I mean, like, I'm in Taiwan
and like you're in like New York. I'm saying across everybody sitting in all locations in all places, all functions, nobody has opened 70% of the roles. And in fact, you can see how all the clustering happens amongst the small number of companies that everybody wants to work at.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That visibility is so alluring. And I think it probably takes people a long time to understand how big the industry is.
Yeah.
That there just is quite a lot out there.
Yeah.
And you'll talk to people who have like a specialized job at a small company that makes a unique product, mm-hmm. and you'll have never heard of it, and you never would have.
Yeah.
And you'll hear them talk about how interesting their work is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? And like, don't you want to be that person?
Yeah.
100% true. And it's like, and as the three of you know, the modalities of work that we have now are changing. Like mm-hmm. There's going to be an increasingly slowly, I think, decreasing number of like big traditional AAA houses. I see a big change happening already to these smaller models of 10, 20, 30 people. And the team is kind of like an accordion. And, you know, they use places like Keywords and Virtuous and External Development and other contractors and even other more specialized people for back-end services or for go-to-market or for metrics or whatever. And the point of the matter is, like, we could have a very healthy debate on, like, long-term safety and security of those jobs. And, like, obviously that does concern me versus the old model. But the point of the matter is more and more in the jobs are going to be in those places. And I'm sure many people didn't start their career being like, well, I want to go work in external development at XYZ place. But at the end of the day, when you're actually there doing it, like you said, Lydia, it's not like it's somehow, like, magically different from working somewhere else. I think a lot of it is very, very similar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we've been discussing a lot about communities in terms of like finding jobs and stuff and different communities that Amir has been working on and such. We also have a community that you can use as a resource.
No.
Yes.
Whoa.
I know. It's
great. How do I?
Go to nicegames.club/discord. Join us there. You can be a part of the conversation about all of the different episodes we have. You can have conversations with people about a bunch of different topics, things that maybe we didn't even cover on the show. I'd be curious to hear y'all's take about the job market and maybe people's experience with looking for work if you feel so inclined. But if not, and you just want to talk about random things, you know, it's summer. There's a lot of new games being announced. That's exciting stuff.
Ooh. Actually, I know. Uh-huh. Tell us your elevator pitch, your three things.
Ooh.
That would be fun.
I love that. That's great. Yeah. That's great.
If that's not in the first half of the episode, you'll know what we're talking about later.
Uh-huh.
I'm always never sure about these things.
We'll never know. But
you'll find out.
Yeah. You can go to nicegames.club/discord and join us. Just because you're working in something that isn't necessarily games specifically doesn't mean, one, you can get those skills that are required from it, but also there's nothing stopping you from working on games after the fact.
Actually, that's a great segue. Yeah. So we talked about community, and you said the best thing would be to make sure, one, you can eat and are housed.
Mm.
Cool. We've got that covered. The well-meaning but not great advice I've had has been just make games. And so when you are talking about upskilling or learning new skills, meeting new people, what does that actually look like? And how do you do that without dangerously going into the grind set that will burn you out before you even get a job in games?
That's a great question. I actually really like the way you put it. So what I would say is I think of all of that stuff with a pretty simple wrapper, and it's this. At the end of the day, everything, because of everything we've discussed up to this point, is a visibility and a numbers game. Mm. So the question becomes, how are you going to break those numbers and be more visible? And I think that is a very personal decision that differs for every single person. Some people are going to be like, well, I'm going to go to events. Some people are like, well, I'm going to have a blog or I'm going to post on social media. Some people are like, well, I'm going to make games or be part of jams. Some people are like, well, I'm going to go on ArtStation and make a portfolio. My advice when I say all of this to people is like, great, all of the above. But at the end of the day, imagine that you're trying to look for a job and you've just started your process of looking. What I always say to people is go through this mental exercise of, if I'm random hiring manager X and I'm sitting in Bellevue, Washington, and I don't know you, how am I going to find out that you exist? Mm. If that pathway is finding out because you cold applied your application in the box on the site, no chance. I tell people at this point in time, and I again don't mean this to be negative, I'm just trying to be honest, I basically think cold applications are wasted time. Mm. And so I tell people, spend 10% of your time making sure your CV, LinkedIn, et cetera, are perfect. Then basically don't look them at them again. And your job is not applying to jobs. Your job is making yourself visible and desirable as a hireable applicant. Huh. And doing that with that dreaded word of networking, that's fine. That's just a big buzzy word. But it's basically, how do you make yourself discoverable and likable to other people?
Mm. Oh my goodness, it's just like dating.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. But hey, in a very introverted industry, before you said networking, you said all of these things that you can do that get you out into the internet and beyond that don't require you to go and meet a bunch of people in MeetSpace.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think that, like, I think this is why I was kind of thinking about it in terms of dating, because, like, I think a lot of people will be like, well, I once I was not trying so hard to meet somebody and I was just trying to work on myself, I ended up finding somebody and it worked out.
And it always feels like, come on.
Yeah, but
yeah, right? That is how it works.
Part of that reason is because, like, in a dating sense, you need to realize that you are worth being in a relationship and you need to establish that for yourself. And so when you're talking about a job situation, you need to make yourself, you need to establish that you are worth hiring in that same vein.
Can I link that?
Yes.
To back to what you said, kind of one analogy I've heard from my single friends that they've found comfort in when trying to find stuff with dating is, mm-hmm. the reason why it's so good to go to events that are related to a special interest is it's essentially your mating dance.
Yeah.
It is something that you love. It is something that you are passionate about and you are just in your moment, in yourself.
Right.
And that is what ultimately should be the thing that's attractive to mm-hmm. others, instead of you trying to sell yourself.
Yes.
You are being yourself.
That's it. And it's just slow.
Yeah.
Like, this is why I say to people, if you want to back into why it takes so long and the 1 year odds are so low, it's because I'm just being totally honest. At this point, if I take a look at 100 people and you give me 5 minutes to look at each of their profiles, I swear to you, I can predict with some high level of accuracy which people are probably going to come out of the shoot really quickly within the first few months and be like, they place back. Most of the time, it's a preset of, like, they've got the experience, they've got the credentials, but way most importantly, they're just super, super connected or publicly visible.
Right.
Mm. I think some people have already built that up. It's also why I tell people that the biggest mistake you can make is, okay, unfortunately, which I hope doesn't happen to anyone, I've lost my job. Okay, now I'm going to start doing all these things. Mm. I tell people, and I know this seems stressful, but I promise it's not. And it's what I try to do, although I certainly don't do it perfectly. I try to be in this mindset every single day, whether I have a job, whether I don't have a job. Always networking, always being aware of the job market, always having your application materials ready to go at the drop of a hat. Because I think the reason that time takes so long is there is no cutting corners to the, and I know this is going to be a shocking number, but I think it's true, the, like, 2 to 4 years of effort that it takes to, like, properly network and build a relationship with someone.
Mm.
Because as the three of you know, because you're veterans, the, like, writing someone and being like, please hold on to my resume, please let me know if you have any openings. Please let me know whatever. It just doesn't work. You have to be like, hey, can I get a coffee with you? And then the second time you're like, I'll see you at this event that's in 3 months. And then the third time you see them, it's like, oh, it's good to catch up. I read your blog and it was so interesting for Yubidiuk. And then you see them a fourth time, 15 months later. And now the person is like, oh, Lydia, nice person, good person, has the goods. Anyway, you get what I'm saying.
Yeah. That also makes a lot of
sense. I agree, that last part especially.
That also makes a lot of sense because if you're lucky enough to get your foot in the door, regardless of the size of your team, it takes a while for you to get a rapport and get a working relationship with someone who then the people that you would most be able to advocate for you or most be able to go into their own communities and go, oh, that's an Amir-shaped job. I should let him know. That's your teammates.
Right.
But that takes a long time to develop as a relationship and for them to get to know you on that level, because then they're also the ones who would be keeping an eye out for you. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it also, I mean, it ties it all together, this idea of like, you actually have to be kind of interesting to be interesting enough to hire.
Right.
And nice.
And so there isn't like a step-by-step, and it seems like we're circling this notion of like, well, you need a network, you need to put things out publicly, you need to have a unique perspective. There needs to be a U-shaped job out there, you know, that you can fill.
Mm.
And that requires you to be unique and interesting and all of those things.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really, it can kind of be anything.
Yeah.
But it sort of just has to be you.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of the tough reality of like, well, there's probably a lot of great jobs you could do that actually, that you would not find yourself building yourself towards because it's not you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's probably hard for people because especially when you're in a situation where you will just take any job. And with the good advice is to take jobs maybe that you wouldn't necessarily be your dream job. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of a fundamental kind of tension there, right?
Yeah. I really appreciate the way that you talked about how to like put yourself out there in that way. Like you should do it on your own terms, the way that you want to do it, as long as you're actively doing it. And like networking can look different for every person. I when we first started this program, remember when I was talking about networking and how much I hated it?
Yeah.
And I still feel that way. Oh, but yeah. But I've changed my tune in it some, because when we went to GDC, I was so excited to meet a bunch of people and talk to people. I was like really interested in doing that the whole time.
Yeah.
In a way that I was surprised about myself for doing that. And I think part of it was because I had different motivations. I was looking for work. But also because like I have met people and I was interacting with people that I have met and we were like having more rapport and getting to know each other a little bit better and like just interacting more. And I get to meet more people through those people and it expands and grows.
Yeah.
And that works for me, but that might not necessarily work for other people. But like the way that you can network through people is like finding communities that you feel fit for you. Like maybe GTC isn't that place, but like maybe you also really like webcomics and you want to talk about webcomics. And so you go to a webcomic con and they end up, and some of the people there are artists and like they're looking to hire you specifically because they need help making a game or something.
Or board games.
Or board games or what have you. Like there's so many different ways that like you can go interact with people that isn't just, I need to get a job.
I love the way you said it. It's just there's so many creative options.
Yeah.
And to point of all the stuff we're all mentioning, it's like the thing I also tell people is like, is it like an A leads to B that like you do this and you do that and you do the other and then that's going to create the job? Unfortunately, no, right? It's like the classic like necessary but not sufficient. Like
I guess
all I'm trying to say is you all captured it perfectly. It's like that's what networking looks like to me. And the point is, the people who do it well really put a lot of time and effort into it. They like post on LinkedIn every day.
Right.
They do like their blog or whatever every day. Like, and I know that this is not equal and not fair because, for example, going to events is very expensive. It costs money. It biases people, particularly in the US, to like who live in California. And when people tell me that, I'm like, you're right. I can't possibly dispute that that's true. But at the end of the day, it's just about exposure. Even for me, for example, I do my absolute best to be almost like, you know, RoboCop, like impartial. think about everyone like the same, to remember everybody the same. But at the end of the day, I'm like a human being. And if someone writes me and is like, Amir, we need an engineer for such and such job with 12 years experience, I'm going to go through my brain, I'm going to go through my data, and I'm going to be really methodical, but I'm going to remember some finite number of people who I've at least met or had exchanged a note with or seen in person.
Right.
It's just impossible. Like, no one who's not an ATS system can remember like 5,000 people perfectly in their head.
Yeah. I mean, that it's not A to B is,
yeah.
I mean, I'm just remind me of like, you know, I've talked about how I got to work on Blippo.
Yeah.
Which was, I built a game engine for Playdate that I gave away for free. And then in that, through at an event, I mentioned to someone that I'd shipped a Switch game.
Yeah.
And then I ended up working on the Switch version of a Playdate game. Like, it just doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Like, it makes no sense at all how I got that, how I got connected that way.
Yeah.
And at no point in that was I doing like the, there is the kind of networking, which is the real high effort kind of networking that certain people are very good at, where it's deliberate. I'm strategizing. I know how this works. And to make it seem like I'm not trying at all.
Yeah.
I don't think most of us are good at that. No. I know that I'm not good at that. The networking I've done, I look back and goes, oh, dang, that was networking.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that should maybe hopefully ease some people's minds about having to learn that difficult skill. Now, if you can put that effort, it sounds like it is worth it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there are things you can do that are networking that you kind of won't know it till after the fact, I suspect.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. If we, because I also really did appreciate your, have your things ready so you can share it at a moment's notice, because I accidentally networked twice on my honeymoon, and that was one of the major things that actually got me into making a website, which I should put more work into, but I have one now.
Mm-hmm.
Hey. What is the thing that you should have in your back pocket always ready for those moments when you accidentally talk to someone about the fact you make games, and they think that's cool, and you want to be able to give them something, some evidence.
How do you not miss those opportunities?
Right.
But also that is complicated with our industry because we have NDAs and, you know, games that get canceled.
Yeah.
So what do you think is that kind of equivalent of a calling card?
I think the equivalent of a calling card is, people use the elevator metaphor, like the elevator metaphor, but I like more than just like running into a friend in a coffee shop metaphor, which is like, if I ran into you in a coffee shop, and I didn't know you at all, and like a mutual friend was introducing me to you, or I was meeting you for the first time because, I don't know, you saw my backpack and it had like the Alliance logo on it or something. And you were like, Amir, what do you do? Think about what you're going to say in 30 seconds to that person that meets the balance of not sounding robotic and rehearsed, like you're giving them some type of like B2B sales pitch, but also interests them and conveys to them what you're doing. So like, for example, I always tell people, I'll give my own example. If people like ask me what I'm doing, I basically know the three things. I always try to keep like two or three things in my head that I want to emphasize. I want them to know that I've done BD for 2 decades in both games and other fields, so they know that I'm kind of diverse in what I've done. 2, I want them to know about the community and everything that I've done. And 3rd of all, I want to emphasize to them that beyond just like doing a job, I'm very, very engaged with games and play like a shitload of games and like read about the industry constantly. And so like, those are my 3. For some people, I've seen all kinds of things that were really interesting and compelling. I remember once, this is a real example. There was an amazing young lady who was in like marketing and community stuff. And hers was that she had also done that in like music and had gone like on the road with some artists, not even like names, but like on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And the 2nd was that she was into ballet. And the 3rd one is that she had like a dog that she really loved.
Aww.
Like all 3 of these things, it was like someone like the bullseye. It was like bullseye, bullseye, bullseye. Like the person was just like so enchanted. And that led to a lunch 2 months later, and that led to a job 5 months later because of the ballerina and dog story.
Yeah.
Now again, every time I say this, people are like, Amir, you said I should tell stories and I didn't. I'm not saying it guarantees anything, but these are like the right practices.
So you're not even saying like, oh, have your resume and make sure you have the hyperlink on you. You're saying like, kind of give yourself like a nugget of information that you can share that shows what you do, but also who you are.
100%. Imagine it this way, right? Imagine that all three of us are together and we're at Games Beat or GDC or DICE or whatever you like. You know what it's like for devs who are there. Like, they're trying their best. I think 99% of the people in the industry are super, super nice. But it's like, imagine you're a person from insert desirable company here. Mm-hmm. I am sure that if there are young people at the event like GDC or Gamescom or whatever, 100 people are coming up to you saying, I'd like to get an in. Can I talk to you? Can I do whatever? In my experience, people are just tired. They're doing their other meetings. They want to have a fun conversation with someone who's interesting and that is memorable. I would say that if you want the cherry on top, I think a business card isn't a bad idea, mm-hmm. particularly if you make a really cool business card, like the ones that are really interesting or memorable and stuff like that. I think that's pretty cool. I think anything more than being memorable in a business card is probably overkill.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I've definitely received a lot of really interesting business cards from kind of boring people.
Sure.
And so my impression of the interesting business card is like, it's a gimmick.
Uh-huh.
But if I meet someone who's interesting and I'm like, who is that person? I will. Oh, right. They gave me an interesting business card.
Yeah.
So you kind of need both, I think. Because I think people have probably also heard the gimmicky business card might be overplayed. But I think it's probably a good idea.
It helps.
It can be paired with, like, are you actually worth, like, digging that out of the drawer?
Right. Well, it's a way for people to remember where to get information.
Yeah.
So, like, it's useful for that reason.
I'm just feeling I now need to go back to beginner mind and just do what I did when I somehow got my first job in game dev, because I made my own business cards out of leftover construction paper at my retail gig. And I walked up to who the art director was at the time. She was crocheting a bee. Mm-hmm. And I asked her about it because I was trying to teach myself how to crochet. And apparently I was the only person who didn't ask her for a job that day.
What's so funny about this story, Lydia, is that you asked Amir what this situation you just described should be. And he described exactly the situation you had.
I know. And the thing is like...
And I would say, of the mix of those two, right? I was just putting it out there because I hear you. A lot of people, and I get it, they feel like they're almost like naked if they don't give something physical to the other person.
Yeah.
I think between those two things that I said, just being a human and leaving a good memory with the person or a cool story and the business card, I would say I think like the former is 10 times more important than the latter. Yeah. Yeah, that's what really matters.
Well, I think also for me, maybe this is something other listeners could relate to, but there's the sense of needing qualification.
Yeah.
The proving like, yes, I'm a person that is valuable and worth talking to. Here are my credentials.
Mm-hmm.
Which can also sometimes, if you don't have any of that because your foot isn't in the door or you don't have any games because, you know, stuff happens in the games industry, you feel like you're at a disadvantage.
Yeah.
And even if you do have them, then it's always like, but is it enough? Is it what they want? Do I have that proof? And I'm hearing that that's not what they're looking for, that actually just being a person who's decent is going to then lead to the conversations that then, you know, proof in the pudding.
I suspect a lot of that is because there are many people who are as talented and experienced as you out there. And so these are the differentiators.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think all of that is spot on. And it's like, you know, here's an even like more subtle thing, which I know reason people will disagree with me on. I know some people, the moment they talk to someone, are like, can I connect with you on LinkedIn? And they have the QR code ready to go out of the holster like it's a gun.
Yeah.
And it's like, I get that. And I know a lot of people are fine with that. I've always preferred the softer touch, which is just have the conversation, enjoy it, go about your day, and then like the next day or even like a few days after that trip is over, write the person a nice LinkedIn message and say, it was so nice to meet you, yada, 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 nothing creepy, something just kind of short. I always like that because one, you don't force the person to connect with you if they're uncomfortable doing it because they just met you. Mm. Two, you're giving them a second time to remember who you are several days after they may have forgotten after a busy few days. And three, to your point, Lydia, now they at least have to look at your name in their message box and there's a good chance that they might open up your profile and now look at your profile. So that's how I usually play.
Mm, that makes sense.
Yeah, give people a reason and make the... make the friction as low as possible.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
If they're not interested in you, then it doesn't matter how frictionless the experience is.
Right.
But if they're a little bit interested in you, make it as easy as possible.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. And if you write them and they pay no attention or ignore it, well, then they probably would have ignored you anyway.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. You can't trick people.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You actually have to be interesting to them. That's the actual secret.
I hate how much this sounds like dating. I can't stand it.
Well, okay.
Well, it reminds me. I met my wife on Match.com, and God bless, we've been together for 17 years. And to me, I laugh when you say this, because I feel like now people tell me what dating is like. I feel like back then it was like applying to a job. It's like, Jesus Christ, I'm like a cover letter.
In a lot of ways, it's the same thing. Now there's just dating apps, and it makes it weirder.
Having been off the dating market for an extremely long time, I have no idea how any of this metaphor relates. But I will say, what it does remind me of is this notion of competition.
Yeah.
Which I want to get your thoughts on, because I think there is another tension with a community like yours, where you want to support anyone who comes in, give them the resources they need. But at the same time, a lot of the advice is like, how do you make yourself different from everybody else?
Yeah.
And this is, I would say, from what I know of other industries, I think just because of the numbers, there isn't as much need to have a public profile if you're going to work, you know, in certain other fields.
Yeah.
Right? That a lot of it is a lot more about engineering your resume to get through the machine or whatever.
Yes.
And that's kind of maybe all you can do for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you, Amir, how would you advise people to stand out? Do they need to do the thing that when you like pitch a game to a publisher, for example, you try to like assess the market and say why you're different, and maybe even change your design so that it is unique and more marketable. Mm. Is that applicable in the job market, or is it much more about just be who you are and the best version of that, even if it's something that is very similar to a lot of other people are?
I think it's the second.
Okay.
So I think as a default of what I think is the best thing any human being can do, I think being yourself. If you're a serious person, be serious. If you're a complete goofball, which I am, be like a complete goofball. I feel like if you're not being yourself, you'll eventually get found out. I think it is true that because by nature, and I think any community that is trying to support anybody anywhere in anything, at some point provides scalable advice or resources that everybody can use. What I would say is, and I again mean this in the nicest way possible, you can give the exact same advice to 1,000 people. I think you're going to immediately, over even 3 months, get a very clean distribution of how much people apply themselves to actually doing that and to actually doing it well and being thoughtful about it and advice. I'll give you an example. On our site, we have these 2,000 community coaches that give free conversations. I'm delighted to tell the three of you that we've given 100,000 plus of these free conversations, which is so exciting, right?
Congrats on that milestone. Wow.
Jeez Louise.
Thank you. Well, all the credit is to the community, right? Because they're giving their time. What I can tell you is how people take on those conversations is highly uneven. Now, look, it's a little bit difficult because even if we have 5,000 coaches, there's so much demand. And like the jobs, everyone wants to talk to the people at Blizzard, Activision, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it's tough because it's asynchronous and some people get too many responses and requests and they can't respond to all of them. Anyway, there's definitely a group of super users, and this is totally fine, right? That's what the resources there is for. There is a group of super users who over 4 years have told me they've talked to like over 30 coaches in our community to get advice from them, to get help, and to get whatever. And there's an extraordinary number of people that I know have talked to zero. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the day, I believe there's three main reasons that these processes work out or don't work out for people. One, which is completely unfair, is the starting advantages or disadvantages people have. Mm. Some people grow up with different demographic backgrounds. Some people grow up with more or less money. Some people grow up with more or less connections. That stuff is not fair, and it is the pre-existing advantages. Some of those are semi-fair in that some people have gone to more prestigious schools, have worked at more prestigious companies, and so forth. That and your record and what you have is pretty hard to change under the gun when you're looking for a job. So I think that's factor one. Factor two to me is For all that is offered up, how much do people actually put in the effort to do it? And then I would say the third one is some combination of the extent to which people induce flexibility in their search with some combination of luck. Like some people, which I understand for a variety of reasons, are like, I won't move anywhere for any reason. I won't change industries for any reason. I believe if you basically combine these factors, you will get your explanation from what happens. And so since within those, the only two controllable ones are your level of effort and how flexible you are, that's why I emphasize those two things all the time.
That makes sense. Definitely going to consider how I've been applying to jobs too. This is like putting a lot of things in that.
Yeah. I think I want to, that's a great note to go out on. Yeah. I think one thing that I kind of want to do as a little bit of an epilogue on this is talk a little bit about the different types of people looking for work. So, and really just at this table. Yeah. So between you and me, Stephen. So I think a lot of this advice applies to a lot of the efforts you've been doing to find work, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And in prior to the jobs you had previously, similar, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Whereas I don't generally follow that path.
Sure.
Right? I'm looking to work on my own projects. I don't have a games resume.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Right? Even though I've worked in games for a decade. Mm-hmm. And so every now and again, I'm like, should I like actually just work somewhere? Like, I do wonder about that. So I'm very curious, Amir, about not advice for me necessarily, because I'm unhelpable. But
it's terminal.
It's too late. But what I mean to say is a lot of people who are listeners to this program are indie self-starters.
Yeah, yeah.
They're making their own games. They're doing all the research on Steam Next Fest.
Right.
They're doing all the, like, how do I pitch to a publisher? That's the hard struggle that represents their lives.
Yeah.
A lot of them have not considered, frequently because of the networking availabilities, the geographic factor, a lot of them have not considered, oh, actually, I should just go work at a company.
Mm.
Like, can you talk a little bit about that audience? And do those types of people come into your community? And are they especially lost? Because I imagine that might be the case. Or have they picked up skills that might make them actually suitable or desirable in ways that other people who are much more on a career path don't have?
Definitely. I mean, it really does depend by function. Like, yeah. I know, again, I say this with a lot of sympathy with Steven, because some of my best friends are game designers, and I know game design is just hard.
Yep.
It's one of the fields that's the hardest to kind of point to other fields. I might add a little bit unfairly, because I think there are a lot of jobs outside of games that game design prepares you well for.
Yes.
But I know that some fields like game design, like QA, like writing a narrative, for a variety of reasons, some of them are harder. So I would just say, for some of those categories, I think it just takes time, especially if someone hasn't done anything else. And a lot of these things, like the coaches that we have, looking at other jobs in those areas, I think can help. But I would say for the 70 to 80% of people that aren't in some of those much harder fields, I think a lot of it is just getting people those reps of looking at those other jobs. And what I always tell people when they come in, even for game designer writing and narrative, is I say, you know what? I want you to almost, I talk about steps that you're taking, right? What I tell people is, take exactly what you've done or what you were trained for. Okay, so let's say you're a person in production. Okay, doing production in games is you're doing the exact same thing that you've been doing. If I have you take one step outside of that, let's say now instead of production, you're doing like project management at like Microsoft for, I don't know, Office. I would consider that one step away.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Two steps away, maybe now you're doing project management for like, you know, a hospital or something like that. That's two steps away. Or maybe what somebody wouldn't say, it's 2.5 steps away. Maybe for some people, it's even a much bigger retooling, where someone who was in production is like, well, I can do this thing that's like quasi sales or like business development, because it really is just organizing flow and talking to people and so forth. Anyway, you get my point. And so what I tell people is, sit down with a piece of paper and write down every single job you can think of that you even possibly could be qualified for that's two steps away from what you're doing now. Write down all the industries you could work in. Write down all the functions you could work in. And for many people, when I do this, and I say this again with a tremendous amount of sympathy, they've done one thing for like 15 years, and it is, like you say, just like a total freeze. They're not even sure what to write down.
Yeah.
If that happens in a way, that's good, because I can usually get people from a freeze to writing like 5 to 10 things down on the piece of paper. Mm. I think that is everything, because rather than just feeling really defeated or feeling lost or feeling scared, the more you can do that, the more you can actually get a wider aperture of what you could look at, and then you can go from there.
Yeah.
Yep. Sometimes it's literally just a matter of perspective, because I've been doing the same thing for 8 years or whatever, and now I have to try to find a new thing. And it's difficult to think of myself as anything but the thing I've been doing for so long.
Yeah, yeah.
And so recognizing it's taken me a long time to get to this point, over a year, I guess.
Yeah, that's a long time.
Yeah, yeah. But recognizing that, like, I have skills and abilities and interests outside of just the specific thing that I have been doing for so long.
Yeah.
Really helped me at least feel more content about my place in the job market.
It's sort of a dispassionate cataloging of yourself.
Yeah.
Right? Not necessarily your hopes and dreams, but really who is sitting across the table from the interviewer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I suspect, as Amir's hinting at and you're saying,
yeah,
everyone will find more in there than they probably think.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we define ourselves and, like, you know, that can be calcifying.
Yeah. Yeah. Just got to open yourself up to it.
Yeah, and for me, it's like I almost think of that movie like Benjamin Button. It's like if I think about what I did, right? I worked in investment banking. Then I worked in healthcare BD and strategy. Then I worked in tech BD and strategy. Then I worked in games BD. Then I worked in games production for a while. And then I worked in games BD again. Yeah. So I'm like, well, okay, if I was going in reverse and I had done the games BD and games production first and I had lost my job, well, could I have gone into tech BD? Yeah, I think I probably could have.
Yeah.
And then could I have gone from tech BD into healthcare? Yes, I probably could have. So it's like, this is also interesting. I often will go to, when I need like a boost or an idea for someone who's stuck, I'll play the Benjamin Button game and look at someone who I know was a late career switcher like me. And I'll be like, well, if they were going to go in reverse, what would they do?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's a different dimension, right?
Right.
You can go up from back where you came.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I very much appreciate this conversation because we're approaching it from so many different perspectives, so many different ways to go about getting a job. That's not just get a job.
Oh.
One thing I will say is people have been telling me for a while, my dad has been telling me for a while that you need to treat getting a job as your job.
Yeah.
And that is a lot of pressure. Because, like, you know, first off, when you have a job, you're getting paid and you're able to support yourself in that way. When you're looking for a job, you're not. Well, if you're looking for a job, you don't have a job. You're not. I think that, like, it puts so much pressure on you to, like, find the job quickly as possible. But, like, we're talking about all these different ways that you can make it work for you. Finding a position that works for you, that is exciting for you to want to do. And I think that is just so very appreciative. I feel a lot more hopeful about my position right now because of this conversation.
It truly feels like we're asking something that runs on geologic time to run on human time.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you saying that, Stephen. And what I'll say again, not for us, but I especially say this a lot for early career folks, is I can't stress enough as one like closing thought that I tell them all the time that while I understand, because I've been unemployed, I know what it feels like, right? I know what it feels like to walk to the unemployment office. It's hard. You feel humiliated. You feel like you did something wrong, which of course you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And you shouldn't feel any of those things. Easier said than done, right? Yeah. But anyway, even though the inclination is just to apply to stuff, one of the biggest things I say to people is, like, I tell them, promise me. I'm like, just force yourself for even 2 weeks to be like 80% plus of my time is going to be spent, one, like Steven said, treating it like a job, looking for a job. But two, I'm going to spend 80% plus of my time doing literally anything that is not just looking at jobs and applying to jobs.
Yes.
And when people say to me, well, what does that even look like? I'm like, well, that's the point.
Yeah.
If like you can't identify things to do other than doing that, you need to put more time into thinking about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. I love that so much. That's great. My dad needs to hear that.
You can send your dad this episode.
He won't listen.
All right. That's our show. You can find ASGC and Amir online at asgc.gg and on LinkedIn. For those and additional links from today's conversation, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode, or others, or whatever, with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be looking at discussing scope and inspiration through research. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.